Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Blumenthal Arts is known for bringing Broadway shows to town and for sponsoring appearances by musical artists, dancers, and others in their various theaters around town. But last year, they tried something new and different, the Immersive Van Gogh exhibit. Put attendees into that artist's work, allowing them to experience it in a whole different way. I'm putting it mildly when I say that that experiment was a resounding hit, and it gave the Blumenthal an appetite for more. So now, they have opened a new venue just for these experiences. Bloom Studios in the city's new Iron District has just opened, and their first experience is phenomenal. I don't have the vocabulary to tell you what this is like. Space Explorers the Infinite is unlike anything you have ever experienced before, I guarantee it. And at least from my perspective, it's worth every moment you spend there because it takes you on board the International Space Station through virtual reality. But Bloom Studios is offering another, more down-to-earth experience in their Stage 2 building. Faulty Towers allows you to immerse yourself in that British sitcom because you are a guest at their restaurant. It's dinner and a show and a lot more than you're bargaining for. Let me just say that. We're going to talk about that later on in the program. We're going to start with Space Explorers, and joining us for this adventure is Tom Gabbard, President and CEO of Blumenthal Arts, Eric Albert, the CEO of Phi and co-CEO of Infinity Experiences, and Felix Lejeunesse is co-founder of Felix and Paul Studios and the Chief Creative Officer of Space Explorers the Infinite. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Tom, let me start with you. We're going to talk about Bloom Studios and the concept of it as we go through this hour here. But it's located in this place called the Iron District. And a lot of people may not know what the heck I'm talking about or where that is or why it's called the Iron District because, like Bloom Studios, it is new. So fill us in.
It's very new. People in Charlotte have known it as Charlotte Pipe and Foundry. And for over 120 years... it's been one of America's premier pipe and foundries. They have moved, and so now we're in the process of helping them create this great amenity for Charlotte. It's 55 acres, and our warehouse, which is only 8 years old, so it's in great shape, is close to the stadium. So a lot of people have seen it, but not necessarily known exactly what it was. Now they will.
And you have two quote-unquote stages there, and in stage one is this space experience that we're going to talk about. But you've envisioned these new facilities as places where you can produce experiential opportunities for audiences to come and not just watch or sit in a chair, but be part of what they're looking at. And this started with this Immersive Van Gogh exhibit that you mounted about a year or two ago. Why is it so important? Why are these immersive experiences suddenly so important to Blumenthal?
Well, we've found with Van Gogh that even though our database is really expansive, we have 1.5 million accounts, 80% of the folks who came to that show had never bought a ticket from Blumenthal. And so it helped us see that there was an audience out there that, as expansive as our programming was, we still weren't touching. You know, there are a lot of people these days that want to be actively engaged with the arts. They want that creative experience, but they want to touch, they want to move, they want to connect to that experience with other people in a communal way. And so these immersive experiences give the public an opportunity to have that kind of creative experience.
Eric Albert is with us. He and Felix Lejeunesse are the masterminds behind this space exploration exhibit that they have going, Space Explorers the Infinite. It's the first collaboration between Phi Studios and Felix and Paul Studios. Eric, how did the two of these organizations come together, and what do each of you bring to the table for this experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mike. Bai and Felix and Paul have actually been collaborating for close to 10 years now. The Infinite is the first large-scale immersive experience that we do together. However, we've been partners in multiple projects over those 10 years. What's interesting with The Infinite is that Felix and Paul have this experience and expertise in capturing and storytelling amazing content. Bai, on the other hand, has this expertise in building installations and contextualizing the content. So by combining our expertise, we were able to come up with an experience that really features and focuses on the amazing content that was captured by Felix and Paul in the International Space Station, while also making sure that the visitor journey, the onboarding process, for example, because it is virtual reality and some people have never been exposed to virtual reality. So making sure that people have this onboarding and offboarding and they know exactly what they're going to do when they do the experience, that's part of the expertise that Bai brings to the table.
This is, I was told, and I'll bring this up again probably later in the program, I was told by one of the people who helped guide you through this process that this is the next best thing to actually being in space. It's also the next best thing to actually being on the holodeck in Star Trek, because it's very much, I think, like that to a great degree. Felix, this... you've been doing this for about 10 years, according to Eric, that you've been doing these kinds of experiences. Why are I ask you the same question that I asked Tom, because this is new. Where did the idea come from and why are they so important, these experiences?
Well, fundamentally, virtual reality offers a fully immersive experience. So you're completely transported physically, mentally, emotionally into another reality. And you experience something that we take for granted in reality, which is a sense of presence, a sense of truly being part of the experience and no longer being a spectator. And so I've been fascinated by this medium for more than 10 years now. We started working with NASA to tell the story of human spaceflight through the medium of virtual reality a couple of years ago in about 2016. And as we built relationships with astronauts, with NASA executives, we eventually pushed the relationship to another level by sending virtual reality cameras to the International Space Station. And the way we presented that to NASA and to the astronauts was literally to say, look, this camera that we're sending to space is an additional crew member. Okay, this camera actually looks like a person because it has the size of a human head. It sees in all directions, it hears in all directions. And we want to make that the additional crew member on board the ISS to be able to allow people on Earth to feel like they are truly there, truly integrated to the mission, truly part of a NASA expedition with fellow astronauts. And that is what we ended up filming for 2.5 years on board the ISS, is all of those multiple moments, scenes, intimate scenes with astronauts living and working in space to bring back that experience of presence to Earth.
And Eric, I was reading, Felix, I'll ask this of you, because I was reading yesterday that you are the first and only entertainment studio in the world to offer a full range of immersive experiences. But many people have been to Disney World or Disneyland, and the Walt Disney Company also tries to do this. Yours is different. For those people who have experienced Disney World, they think, well, I've been to Epcot, so I know what this is all about. They really don't. So explain the difference.
Well, fundamentally, what we offer with a show like the Infinite is an experience that is completely immersive from beginning to end. Eric evoked earlier that this show is really designed as a journey. The moment you cross the door, you enter the story. All of the onboarding before you even go into virtual reality, all of the onboarding is designed to gradually sort of transport you in this other world. And it's designed as a liftoff from the Earth to space. And so as you do the liftoff, you transition to virtual reality. And now you see yourself as an avatar and you see everybody else in your group as an avatar. You can find the people in your group because they are of the same color of avatar as you and the others are of another color. So it's very easy to navigate the world. And then you find yourself in a gigantic space in a life-size reproduction of the International Space Station for about 40 minutes. You get to explore the ISS at your own will. So it's not a predetermined path that you just kind of like go through. It's actually an open-ended large-scale experience, and people go where they want. And based on where they go, they will discover luminous orbs that are geolocalized to all of the places that the virtual reality camera was positioned inside of the space station. So when you activate one of those, you get transported into the real ISS, and you can look anywhere in 3D with astronauts. So it just offers you a design of experience that I believe was the first of its kind, and it's something truly unprecedented. And it's important to mention that it is real. Everything that we film, even when you step out, look at the Earth, it's all filmed. Nothing is generated. It's all captured from the vantage point of people who live in space.
As you were talking about that, as I went through the exhibit, one of my weaknesses is that I always take myself out of the experience and think about process, about how did they do that? How did they figure out where this orb ought to be and where at this stage of the adventure, by touching that orb, I'm going to be transported someplace else or for a brief amount of time. How did they figure out that's when to put that orb there? Maybe we can talk about that. But Tom, these guys have been working on this for years. One of my first impressions of this was how big the space station is. I had no idea it is as big as it is, because you can wander the space station for an hour in this exhibit and you won't have seen it all. I thought it was much, much smaller. What were your first impressions of having gone through this?
Oh, it is so expansive. And that's why, you know, it's actually taken us 3 years to find the space, because we needed very expansive space, limited columns, lots of ceiling height. And, you know, we first started talking about this exhibition 2 years ago, and we just felt like this would be a great way to introduce the concept of an expansive place to enjoy all sorts of shows.
I cannot stress enough, Eric, that this experience, this is not hyperbole, this experience is something most of us will never have in our lives again. Most of us will never go to the International Space Station. And this is the closest we're going to get to this. What makes space seemingly an ideal topic or area of investigation for an exhibit like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your point that most of us will not have the privilege of going to space is right on. We've had several astronauts go through the experience, including Joan Hingbotham last week in Charlotte. And coming out of the experience, you know, at least three astronauts that I've spoken to have said it felt like I was back up there. So people who actually spent time in the International Space Station doing the experience and making a comment that it felt like it was, you know, they were back up there, certainly speaks very loudly in terms of the immersive aspect that Felix was describing before. Space is the next frontier, right? You know, I remember growing up, we would get the afternoons off whenever the space shuttle would take off because it was an event. And I think, you know, I don't know many people who growing up did not at one point want to be an astronaut. I think one element that needs to be mentioned, and I'm sure Tom is going to discuss this a little bit later, but Blumenthal has done this great thing of inviting 14,000 grade six school kids to be able to attend the Infinite over the coming months. This is going to be amazing for them to experience what astronauts actually feel when they're up there. So, thank you.
No, and we will talk about that and much more with regard to Space Explorers, the Infinite, which will be at Bloom Studios through November the 10th. And we'll talk about more where that is. And we'll also talk about Fawlty Towers, which is right next door in Stage 2 a little bit later on in the program. We're taking a break. We're coming right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. At Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org, I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Bloom Studios, which is a new set of venues operated by Blumenthal Performing Arts in the new Iron District, which is where Charlotte Pipe and Foundry used to be before they moved. And we're talking about two of the inaugural exhibits there, or experiences there, let's put it that way. The first of which is Space Explorers, the Infinite. The second of which is Faulty Towers, which we're getting to later in the program. Tom Gabbard is here. He's the president and CEO of Blumenthal Arts. Eric Albert and Felix Lejeunes are both the folks behind two different companies who came together to create this experience. Tom, this is going to be at Stage 1 at the Bloom Studios till November the 10th. It's not the traditional kind of entertainment that Blumenthal has engaged in the past. This is more, particularly this first exhibit, is more scientific to most people than artistic, but it certainly took creative minds to make this happen in a way that is so immersive and so totally believable while you're in it that you think you're on the space station. Talk about that, the fact that creative minds can take science and make it interesting and opening and inviting to people who may not be interested or be intimidated by science.
That is such a fascinating thing about this and what we aim to do ongoing there, this intersection of the arts and technology, the weaving together of that. And I think this gives people an opportunity, especially, you know, Eric mentioned about the 14,000 sixth graders that are coming through beginning this morning. And, you know, for people to realize the potential in themselves, and particularly for our young people to see in this the potential of what they can pursue and how they can integrate the arts and technology. You know, beyond the exhibition, we have a number of local artists who have displays there, and actually half the room is open to the public without having a ticket. And we encourage people to come by and just check that out, because there is some big, bold art that's out there for everybody to enjoy free of charge.
You mentioned, I think Eric or Felix mentioned Joan Higginbotham, who was an astronaut on board the International Space Station, and she was there for the opening day of this exhibit, Felix. And she says that this experience for ordinary people makes you realize, oh, the astronauts up there are real people. I could be there. I could do this myself. Do you see this as inspiring a new generation of future astronauts or space travelers?
Definitely. I think what a show like The Infinite does is that it takes a subject that sometimes seems so far away. You think about outer space, you think about the moon, you think about the space station, and they appear to be, when we are here on the Earth, captive of gravity, they appear to be so far away somehow. And with a show like The Infinite, you're just there. You're just there with the astronauts. You know, experience their daily lives. You look around, they're all around you. They interact with you, they talk to you, and you just feel like suddenly you've overcome that distance and now you're a part of it. You're no longer separated from it. And I think there's something very emotional that happens for audiences, whether they're kids or, you know, middle age or older people. I think that feeling of suddenly overcoming that distance and being a part of something that felt inaccessible maybe to you, I think there's a rush of emotion and a sense of inspiration that you could be doing that maybe, or you could be more involved. And that distance is maybe in our minds, you know, and I think that's what I'm very proud of with the show, is that I think we brought back the experience of space to Earth.
I'm one of those people who would have gone into space in a nanosecond, given the opportunity to do it. And I know it will never happen now, but nonetheless, I would have done it. And I have to tell you that as I went through this, Eric, my vocabulary continually failed me. I just found myself muttering over and over, this is amazing. This is amazing. And it's not only just the fact that the space station itself is amazing, that space is amazing, the experience is amazing. But I wish I had more words. Give me some more words.
I think one word that we haven't talked about, which is very interesting, is the overview effect. And what the overview effect is astronauts that go to space and they view Earth from that vantage point describe it as life-changing, as a spiritual moment, as something that they'll never be able to see, obviously, on Earth. I think one of the things that The Infinite does, because in addition to all the scenes that Felix described before, where you get to see what the astronauts do in their day-to-day activities up on the station, Felix and Paul were able to send a camera back in 2021 that filmed these amazing shots outside of the International Space Station. And if you turn around, you get these amazing views of Earth in virtual reality, which is probably as close to what most of us will ever get to in terms of experiencing the overview effect.
Well, you know, the astronauts who have been to space have talked about that, looking down on the Earth and suddenly realizing how we're all in this together, how we live on this fragile planet, and we live only because of this thin atmosphere that encircles the globe, and without that, we're goners. And you look down on this blue marble, and we've all seen photographs of that blue marble in space. But this is more than that. This is not looking at a photograph. This is being there, looking at it as an astronaut would see it. Did you know going into this that when you took that camera and stuck it up there for 2.5 years or whatever it was, that that's the effect that you could come up with?
We wished for that. We definitely wished for that because we were so inspired by all those stories that you just evoked of astronauts. And because we had been working with astronauts for years and following them for training to go to the International Space Station, we were immersed in the reality, and they were talking a lot about, you know, this desire of them to not only work in space, but look back on the Earth. And we felt if we can only capture that, like if we can get even a glimpse of that through 3D 360, you know, full vista of the Earth, you know, captured from low Earth orbit, if we can get that emotion and bring it back, that would be completely unprecedented and something that goes beyond what a film can do or even an IMAX film can do. It would suddenly bring back that genuine sense of floating above the Earth and looking down at your entire planet as if you were there. And it took about 2.5 years just to prepare for that one shot. So the camera that was utilized to film outside of the space station is a completely different system than the one that was captured inside. And that camera that we call the extravehicular vacuum camera was attached to the Canadian arm of the space station, the robotic arm, and was moved around the ISS outside as a sort of a cinema crane, if you will. And that is what we used. And so just to prepare that, build a camera, send it to space, rehearse with NASA all of the motions that the robotic arm would do to get that shot, and to be able to document a spacewalk as well of two astronauts outside. It literally took 2.5 years of preparation to get to that day of filming. So yes, we really wanted to get that, and we felt it was important and worth it to go out through all of this.
One of the things that makes this so special, I think, is that you don't know as a viewer, even after this program, even after we go through these 40 minutes of explaining this, you're not going to understand what you're in for until you are there and in the middle of it. And one of the things that makes it work there is that just like anything else, you line up, you go in, they explain a few things to you, you're in a black box, essentially. And then you put these goggles on. I'd never had a virtual reality goggle on my face before, but this has audio in it. It has visuals. No matter where you look, if you turn your head up, down, side to side, around, you're going to see a 360 view, which puts you there. When you walk outside the space station, you are spacewalking. There's stars around you. There's the vehicle. How big is the space station, Eric? I mean, I thought it was going to be tiny or small, but it's enormous. How big is it?
It's interesting because the actual station itself, the living quarters, fit pretty much in the space at Bloom Studio. So the space where you do the free roaming virtual reality experience is literally approximately the size of the International Space Station. What makes it look huge is the solar panels. When you're looking at it from the outside, and when you're free roaming outside of the station, you're experiencing some of the orbs that were filmed outside of the ISS. That's where you get to see how big it literally looks. But you know, when there's 10 or 12 people living inside the ISS, it's crowded. So physically, it's not actually not that big. But it is an absolutely amazing sight when you're outside of the ISS and experiencing the views in virtual reality. And then you turn around, and there's one scene in particular, I'm sure Felix can talk about it more, but where you're basically flying over the Mediterranean, you see the northern parts of Africa, you see the Italian booth, the colors, the sights, just experiencing that in itself is probably one of the most magical moments in the experience.
I have to tell you that Tom's wife, Vicky, told me that that was her experience. Unfortunately for me, that was not mine, because one of the things about this exhibit is that you can come to it multiple times, and every time you come, it will be different depending upon which of those glowing orbs you touch that transport you to different experiences. One of the universal experiences, though, I would think, Felix, is that you do feel, at least I did, felt a little disoriented, at least in the beginning, by this experience, because you're no longer on Earth. You almost feel like the Earth has fallen away and that gravity is gone and you're floating in space. And in one of my experiences, I touched one of those orbs, and it was in the middle of a conversation between two astronauts. And I looked to my left, and the male astronaut was doing all the talking at the time, and he was talking. And then the female astronaut responded, and I looked to my right where she is. He's right side up. She's upside down. And you realize, oh, my, there's no gravity here. This is very weird. Did you know that was going to work? Was that just happenstance? How did that come about? Because it really makes you feel you're in the middle of it.
We definitely asked the astronauts to, when they were capturing a scene with us, to play with this idea of zero gravity. You know, they are in space in an environment where there is no perceivable gravity, at least for them. They are actually always in a position where they can choose if they're going to stand sideways, upside down, on the other way, or, you know, in a normal orientation relative to the Earth. It's always a decision of them. And when we would install the camera, we would choose one of the four walls, if you will. You know, when you film on the Earth, you assume that generally the camera goes on the ground, but on the space station, go right. And so we would position the camera and sort of work with them to find an interesting vantage point. And after that, they would play with it. And so in the context of certain conversations that they were capturing, they would intentionally find themselves, you know, upside down relative to one another to reflect that they live in a world different than ours, with different laws of physics to the ones that we have here on Earth. And so we did play a lot with that. And I think that, yes, sometimes it's a little disorienting as you launch a scene and you find yourself with somebody talking to you upside down, but it is their reality. It is the way it is up there in space. If you look at their crew quarters, the way they sleep, some of them are sleeping, you know, up, and some of them are sleeping down, and some of them are almost sleeping sideways. So it's just their reality.
The other thing that struck me is that it's a very un-Star Trek, the inside of that vehicle. It does not look like Star Trek. It looks more like a high school project with dangling wires everywhere. And I would think you're not sure exactly where you can put your feet to propel yourself or your hands, because everything looks very unfinished and haphazard. Only 300 people, Eric, have ever been to the space station. Mm-hmm. About 500,000 people have been through this exhibit as it has traveled. It's new to Charlotte, but you've been on the road with this for a while. How many cities have you visited with this?
So since we launched in Montreal in 2021, we visited approximately 8 cities before getting to Charlotte. The experience is currently in Houston, Texas. It is also in Shanghai, where it opened in July. And it will be opening in Singapore in the next 2 weeks. So our objective with this experience is to try to bring it to as many people as possible so that they get to experience the overview effect that we were talking about before. And they get to experience the life of the astronauts when they're up there. So, you know, world domination could be seen as one possibility. Our objective is to try to bring it to as many people. And I think what Tom and the team at Blumenthal are doing with inviting the 14,000 kids is absolutely phenomenal. And that's what we try to do when we bring this experience to cities around the world, is make sure that they get to experience it.
Eric Albert is CEO of Fi, co-CEO of Infinity Experiences. Felix Lejeunesse is co-founder and chief creative officer of the Felix and Paul Studios that put together Space Explorers, The Infinite, which plays at Bloom Studio Stage 1 through November the 10th. Gentlemen, congratulations on an amazing achievement. There's that word again. And thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Tom.
Blumenthal Arts, new Bloom Studios in the city's Iron District, is offering something else unique, aside from a trip to the International Space Station, something more down to earth, but somehow equally spacey. Fawlty Towers, a dinner theater experience based on the British sitcom that offers you more than you bargain for. The goal of dinner theater has always been to serve a nice meal, maybe not hot, but certainly warm, and then put on a good show. But not unlike the play that goes wrong, and because you're dining at Fawlty Towers, things start to go wrong almost immediately. Thus, comedy ensues thanks to the talents of the three actors involved, all of which are with us right now. Benedict Holm and Karina Garnett play Basil and Sybil, the proprietors of Fawlty Towers, and Lee Kelly is Manuel, the waiter. All are from Great Britain. All three join us now. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Hello, welcome.
And Tom Gabbard remains with us from Blumenthal. Benedict and Karina, I only have about 2.5 minutes left in this segment. We'll come back with more in a moment. But you are the proprietors of Fawlty Towers, and from watching the program on telly, I just wonder why you had the guts to to take this show out on the road.
Well, we've been on the road for sort of many years, sort of 24 years, you know, traveling to various different countries, and it's always received, you know, they love it wherever we go. We went to the United States once before, about 10 years ago. So this was our first major sort of American tour, and so far, so good.
Yeah.
And the reason I use the word guts is because Fawlty Towers, you have such a problem with your own establishment in Britain, that you would inflict that pain on the rest of the world takes chutzpah, it seems.
I think that's what people love to see other people in a situation that they wouldn't like to be in, to laugh at other people's misfortune, which they get the chance to do a lot in this show.
And misfortune, yes, rules the day in this show. We'll come back and talk more about Fawlty Towers at Stage 2 at the Bloom Studios in just a moment. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. In Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins, here with Tom Gabbard, President and CEO of Blumenthal Arts. We're also with us, if you thought the space exploration thing was out of this world, well, Fawlty Towers is right up there with it in a very different way. Benedict Holm and Karina Garnett, are Sybil and Basil, and Lee Kelly is Manuel the waiter. If you've watched the TV show, you know that those three characters are the principal characters in that television program. And Lee, you are the waiter, and you literally, because it's a dinner theater experience, you are literally waiting tables. Do you have any training in that?
Absolutely none.
All three of you, however, are trained actors. I mean, you really have a pedigree, so people should not think that you're just schlepping around the world doing slapstick comedy. You're highly trained actors, and many of you, as particularly you, at Lee, and you, Karina, have been with this production for years. What keeps you going, Lee?
I think it's the audiences. You know, every show is different, really. We are performing, as Ben said, all around the world and in different circumstances, you know, for different types of audience. And every show is unique, really. The audience bring a fourth character to the experience. And we are interacting with them, and the scripts and the situations develop because of the world that the audience bring to us and it. So it changes from show to show. So that's the interest for us, I think.
So you, I think, have been with the show since 2013, and Karina, you've been with the show since 2012. So you're the veteran here. Have you been solidly, steadily with it? Have you done other things in the interim? You come back to it, or is this it?
No,
this is
I've
the thing that keeps you going.
No, I've been doing this off and on all of that time, but I've also worked for lots of other different companies, and I do lots of puppetry, and I've just recently this year made my own ukulele apothecary show. So we do all sorts of different crazy things as well as this, which also travel all over the globe. So it's pretty exciting.
And Benedict, this has traveled all over the globe and played all kinds of very different venues with very different audiences. I'm just curious. This is, I think, is this the U.S. debut for this, or certainly the Charlotte debut?
We did it once in New York in 2015 to a sort of conference type thing. Lots of kind of bookers were interested in maybe taking it on. So obviously that proved successful. We then went to Toronto later in the year, for that was a very long tour. That was 13 weeks. But this is the first U.S. tour.
Do you find audiences in different parts of the world react to this differently? First of all, it's astounding to me that everybody around the world knows this sitcom, Fawlty Towers. But do they react differently? For instance, Charlotte, we're a banking town. We're reserved. Although we do like to have a good time, it's been my experience that people do like to laugh here. But is it different as you go from city to city?
I think we particularly areas that aren't maybe used to sort of theater crowds, maybe got more of a sports culture. In a way, I slightly prefer those, but it's more of a novelty. You know, they haven't really had sort of conventional theater. Whereas, other places where it's, theatres established, especially interactive theatre, they can be kind of blasé about it. Oh, we have this sort of stuff all the time. So it's, we've been to places like sort of Kenya, where it's, you'd think no one would have heard of it. But of course, you get expats and everyone, and, it's astonishing how many people are receptive and love Fawlty Towers.
And like the previous segment when we were talking about the space station, this is... It's a play, but it's not in the traditional sense. It's not on a stage. It's not lit like a theatrical production. It's happening around you as you try to eat dinner in this experience, with the three of you cavorting in amongst the tables and with the guests. There may be people who really get nervous if they feel like the actors are going to call upon them and make them part of the show. They don't want to be part of the show. Just leave me alone. That's not what this is about either, is it?
No, well, it's not fun to pick on those people. We talk about choosing and noticing who the players in the audience are, because some people play too hard and kind of say all of our cue lines for us because they know the show. And some people are so embarrassed, it wouldn't be fun to pick on them because it would make everyone else... It's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. We have to choose people who are just right and play in just the right way for us.
Which is where those years of being on the road with this must come in, because you know all the characters in the audience. You can pick them out. You know who to call upon and who not to call upon. But it seems to me, Lee, that even though there's an outline of a script somewhere in there, that you have to be able to ad lib in the moment, because you, as the actors, never know what's going to happen.
That's right. Yes, I mean things go wrong or differently, and we are there to kind of fill those moments appropriately for the audience. Some people, audience members, might shout out if they kind of like know what happens next, for instance. They've kind of guessed where this story piece is going, or we might turn to someone and ask a question of them, and they give a weird answer that we weren't expecting, and then suddenly we have to try and find something else. And that's part of the skill and the interest for us, I think, is being adaptive like that. The audience, I think it's a kind of like I mean, it can be quite, we do put people on the spot, certainly, but it's not a terrible ribbing. We're not out to kind of, you know, shame anyone or embarrass them. And I think hopefully we're professional enough to kind of put people at their ease quite quickly, that everyone is a potential target, but it might not happen to everyone. And if they are targeted, we're not going to kind of, you know, destroy them in front of their friends and family.
Yeah, we feel safe.
They're having a nice time.
And as we're receptive to kind of, we read the room. We kind of become aware of who's up for it and who perhaps would rather just sit back and enjoy.
I'm happy to report, particularly when it comes to Benedict and Lee, that you both look healthy, but you've been doing this a long time, and this is a very physical show for the two of you. I know, Benedict, that you get slapped a lot in the course of this show, and you are doing somersaults, Lee, and getting up on furniture and getting kicked around. How do you take care of yourselves?
Well, it's a very physical show, and it's also quite a hot, sweaty show. You know, you find yourself kind of slaving under a hot tweed jacket for a couple of hours. What do? We sort of, I mean, these guys have been doing planks before the show, that little exercise. You know, I've been fitting those out. I don't know what my excuse is, but these guys have been having a bit of an exercise.
Keeping our tummy muscles in trim.
You know, the British have a certain comedic sensibility that I think got lost when we came across the pond and became Americans, and which makes it so refreshing and so much fun, because let's face it, Monty Python, John Cleese, all those people from that group have a particular point of view when it comes to comedy that is just gut-wrenchingly funny, at least to me it is. That is ever present in Fawlty Towers, it seems to me. I don't want to give too much away because I want it to be a surprise for people who come. But given some of the things, Karina, that happen in the course of having dinner amongst you three, should we eat before we come?
No, you will get a lovely, delicious three-course meal. So, unless you're really, really hungry, you don't need to eat before you come.
Just be careful of the soup, I'm told.
Yes.
We'll go there. and we're not just spectators in this. We're part of this. And do you ever get people who come and don't know what they got themselves into because they're not, maybe they're guests of people who took them with them? They've never seen Fawlty Towers. They don't understand what's... They think it's going to be dinner theater with the actors up on a stage someplace while they eat in the dark. This is not happening here. This is completely different.
No, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the show is contextual for people who do know Fawlty Towers. And for those that don't, there is still a kind of a structured storyline to our show, which people can follow. And I think... It's a kind of a comedy of manners, really, and status, which I think is familiar to everyone, whether they know the show or not. You know, there's the proprietor of the hotel, Basil Fawlty, who thinks he's the boss, but he isn't. His wife is. She's the boss of him. And then Manuel is the kind of like the lowest rung of the ladder. And I think that's a familiar kind of... status game, a kind of like a familiar characteristic that we all work within somehow. We know this, so I think
we see it in you see it when children come along who maybe are not big fans, but they understand the status. That's immediately right. They love Manuel because they have an experience of possibly, you know, getting into trouble and getting told off. And that's what's happening a lot to Manuel. So they just identify really strongly with that.
And misunderstanding orders from adults. Manuel has a difficulty because he's, I guess, Hispanic. He has difficulty understanding the intricacies of the English language, which has words that sound exactly the same, but mean completely different things depending upon how they're spelled, and that causes him a great difficulty in the course of this evening.
Yeah, he's Spanish. His comprehension is, I think in the TV series, you never really find out how he made his way to Torquay. You know, poached, persuaded mm-hmm. somehow to come over by Basil, but his wife disagrees with Manuel kind of being there. So there's lost within this dynamic of who he's meant to be responsible to.
Tom Gabbard is still with us. He's the CEO of Blumenthal. Go ahead, Tom.
Mike, I just wanted to say, you know, part of how they bring people in is the show actually starts. We have a cocktail hour before you come in for dining, and the actors are actually out there. To me, that's a part of how they loop people in. They begin to build a relationship. You're standing, having drinks together, then they help you with the seating. So by the time you sit down and have dinner, you're already feeling acclimated. You're already feeling some connection with them. They do a beautiful job with that.
I should point out that Sybil and Basil's last name is Faulty, and that is why it's called Faulty Towers, but it's a double entendre because everything that happens in this hotel and this dining experience is wrong, oh, so very wrong. I'm curious, Benedict, because everything does go wrong in the dining room, who's back in the kitchen cooking? I'm concerned about Tomaine and things like that.
Well, this is the reassuring bit because we have a wonderful catering staff where we're getting everything wrong and being on the surface of things very haphazard. The serving staff do a fantastic job of getting everything out on time. So if the diners have any legitimate concerns, they have the fallback option of going to them, who'll sort everything out. They cook up a delicious three-course meal as well.
Well, I'm going to test you here because you are the host of the Faulty Towers Dining Room. What's on the menu?
What is on the menu? It's a lovely soup starter. We've talked a little bit about the soup. There might be some hiccups there, not to give too much away. And then it's a lovely chicken dinner. And what's for pudding? It's a cheesecake.
And there's a vegetarian.
Which is a portobello mushroom.
And some zucchini, I believe you call it over here.
It all looks very delicious. I mean, because sometimes us, the actors, help in sort of the serving and the clearing. And I haven't seen any anything other than a clean plate coming back, which is a bit of a, which is a ringing endorsement of the quality of the food there.
And have we got cheesecake?
We've got a cheesecake
for dessert.
Okay. And of course, the dinner rolls, which play a significant portion there's a plot point involving the dinner rolls. We'll leave it at that. Not everybody has seen Faulty Towers, the TV show. It's been on for years. It's a British import. I think it started, in the 70s? Or the early 80s, 70s? And we get it on PBS over here. But if you haven't seen the TV show, is there anything that you should do to prepare for this adventure?
Watch the TV show.
let me rephrase the question. Is there anything you need to do? Do you need to do that to appreciate this?
No, you don't at all. No. Maybe come prepared to play a little, enjoy yourselves, have a laugh at our expense, and you'll have a lovely time.
But not be worried if you are feeling a little anxious that you don't want people to pick on you. That won't happen. It's not, you'll be safe. It's okay.
And as you rightly point out, the clue is in the title, Faulty. So even
Tom, we talked about this in the past. These experiences. I think the word is hard to find synonyms, but the experience is what you're looking for in terms of both this and the space exploration. And you're trying to find these in lots of different areas and other venues that you operate at Blumenthal. And I know that Andrew Lloyd Webber is experimenting with the same thing in the West End. He is about to do an immersive Phantom of the Opera, which is more than the chandelier falling on top of you. Is this the wave of the future very quickly?
It definitely is. And so that's part of what we're preparing for. When he announced that yesterday, I sent a note to somebody in his office. I said, we're getting your facility ready, Andrew. And so people can expect lots of great things in the future.
Fawlty Towers, Dinner and a Show, is at the Bloom Studio Stage 2 in the Iron District through October the 13th. You can go to get tickets for both of these events. Am I correct, Tom, at blumenthalarts.org? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Benedict Holm, Karina Garnett, and Lee Kelly, all part of Fawlty Towers, and Tom Gabbard. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.